Morning, the preaching, we turn to Psalm 37, one of my favorite psalms, written by King David. The psalm outlines how the righteous people of God live in a world filled with evildoers who not only perpetrate wickedness, but appear to thrive while the righteous appear to languish. And we know the default orientation of the human heart. We live in a world enveloped by wickedness and evildoers. However, when we experience life as flourishing and prosperous, our awareness of wickedness often decreases because as human beings, we seem to be most acutely concerned with wickedness when it directly impacts us in a personal manner. And so when we prosper individually, it's easy to minimize the wickedness around us, the wickedness experienced by others, the doing of evil that pervades the world. And unfortunately, in prosperity, sometimes we can turn a blind eye to evil that does not directly impact us, with the result that we neglect a pursuit of mercy and justice to those who are suffering under evil. In addition, if we judge wickedness by self-centricity, the assessment of a regional or global situation merely by one's own limited experience, we tend to misjudge the reality of the world and claim that evil is on the rise, when in reality we've just merely become more aware of what has already existed, what has already been experienced by so many. Now this might seem to be a splitting of hairs, but I think that self-centricity leads to poor responses when evil comes upon us, and with our actions characterized by a fretfulness rather than an alignment to the prophets, the psalmists, and the apostles. So now in a world where more and more people experience less flourishing, less prosperity than they were previously accustomed, personal awareness of evil doing and wickedness is on the rise. More and more people have a worry, concern about evildoers and the wickedness they perpetrate, not because wickedness did not exist before or in as great fashion, but merely because they were not personally experiencing the repercussions of evil doing. But as God's people, we need a righteous response to wickedness, both perpetrated against us personally as well as the general wickedness of the world. And King David guides us well, for he was a man frequently tyrannized by the wickedness of evildoers. And wicked men, including his own master, King Saul, and then his own son, King Absalom, constantly sought to murder David. The wicked Saul, whom David refers to as the Lord's anointed, twice attempted to strike David down with a spear while David served as a musician in King Saul's court. Of course, we know that David became king after Saul. Afterward, Saul sent hordes of mercenaries after David, endlessly pursuing him in the wilderness. And later in David's life, his son Absalom led a coup to overthrow David's kingship and kingdom, a theological, civil, and political conspiracy that threatened to bring grievous destruction on the nation of Israel. In 2 Samuel 15, 12 and 14, it says, "And the conspiracy grew strong, and the people with Absalom kept increasing. A messenger came to David, saying, the hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom. Then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." Amazingly, David, who's king at the time, deferred the throne to his son, with his people willing to follow David in whatever manner he deemed necessary, since both David and his people trusted the Lord to sort out righteousness. And in verses 15 and 16, it says, "The king's servant said to the king, behold, your servants are ready to do whatever my lord the king decides. So the king went out, and all his household after him." And in Psalm 3, the first listed psalm of David, though not the first psalm he wrote, he wrote Psalm 3 while fleeing from Absalom. The first verse opens, O Lord, how many are my foes, many are rising against me. And so when David writes Psalm 37 and instructs the righteous on how to live in a world filled to the brim with evildoers, he writes as an experienced, authoritative master, a man who speaks with all wisdom and understanding in the matter. And he begins Psalm 37. Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers, for they will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. And David here identifies what I think are probably the two most common human responses to the presence and works of evildoers, fretting and envy. Surrounded by evildoers and witnessing the works of evildoers, people often fret themselves. They get worked up in agitation over evil. In addition, evildoers often experience a prosperity unknown by the righteous because evildoers are willing to resort to unjust means to accomplish their purposes, which often puts them into positions of power over the righteous, who themselves are unwilling to resort to the same ends to gain wealth, power, prosperity, position, and so thereby become objects of oppression. Merely by virtue of righteousness, the righteous will be subject to oppression until the day when God separates the righteous from the unrighteous. And so the righteous are tempted towards envy as they experience this unjust disparity between the righteous and the unrighteous. But neither fretting nor envy are appropriate, because in the end, evildoers will fade and wither to extinction, never to be seen from or heard from again. And though the wicked cause much pain and distress in this life, their work is ultimately brought to nothing. And so rather than fret and envy, the righteous ought to act in a manner that understands the reality of the world, the end of the wicked, the inheritance for the righteous, and the provision of God. And David says in verse 3, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithful. So rather than fret, be stirred up with anxiety and agitation, the righteous ought to trust in the Lord and act according to that trust. They ought to do good, to act in pleasant, desirable, pleasing, beneficial, in morally right goodness to people. Do good. I think we have here, perhaps in the words of David, the foundation for this New Testament concept of good works. The primary overflow of faith unto people is good works, carrying out good to people. Doing good for the benefit of people around us because we are, as the righteous, pleasing to God. So therefore our works are not an attempt to gain God's favor. It's an overflow of God's favor to the people around us. Furthermore, we ought to, as it is rendered here in the ESV at least, dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. Now, translations vary on the exact wording. In fact, almost everyone is quite different. But David essentially expresses, similar to Psalm 23, that the righteous ought to simply live in the place where God has pastured them, grazing in good pasture, being fed faithfully by the Lord himself. Rather than experience the psychological, the emotional distress of envy and fretfulness, the righteous simply rest as sheep pastured in a good land at the hand of God himself, and even gratify in such an existence. He says in verse 4, this is one of my favorite verses in Scripture, and it's easy to pull these verses out, but again, remember, David is writing this in the context of experiencing the works of evildoers. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Before seeing God with spiritual eyes, with the clear vision the Spirit of God gives us, people see God as hard, difficult, as burdensome, the spoiler of plans, the ruiner of their excess. But not so the righteous, who see God with pure eyes and hearts. The righteous delight in the Lord and his ways and enjoy themselves with and in him. Though it's not translated in this way. A lot of scholars kind of render these words as to delight, to be pampered and refreshed in their covenant relationship with God. And those who delight in the Lord accordingly will experience the satisfaction of their desires. Now, the one who delights in the Lord is not a person who is desiring their own ends at the front end of things and then pursuing God as some sort of vending machine in order to get their wants satisfied, but rather a person whose very desires have been formed in a relationship of delight and enjoyment with the Lord. In that covenant relationship, their desires have been formed after the very person and character and works of God. Nothing will be unanswered or unreceived for such a person, for their desires have been formed in accordance with God's own desires. And in the end, though, sometimes such righteousness, such pursuits seem unprofitable, and the righteousness of such living, the righteousness of a person who lives out this life goes overlooked. God will establish the righteousness of his people for all to see. And he says in verses 5 through 6, commit your way to the Lord, trust in him, and he will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. Perhaps one of the more frustrating experiences in life comes when your righteousness goes unseen, while the unrighteousness of an adversary shines like righteousness to those around you. Basically, when you do the right thing but are viewed as the bad guy, while the person who's doing the wrong thing is viewed as the good guy. And perhaps every person ever to exist has experienced this to some extent. Perhaps we think of, in more extreme cases, those who have been unjustly imprisoned, perhaps even for life, suffering punishment for the crime of an evildoer, also while enduring the false assumptions that people are placing upon that person, how they're viewing that person. What a great burden to bear those false assumptions, to bear the false accusations, to bear even slander and libel, to bear the false witnesses that we have sometimes against us. But in the end, for those who commit their path to the Lord, those who establish every direction and movement in the life upon their trust to the Lord, they will be vindicated. Their righteousness, if in fact they are characterized by righteousness, their righteousness, if it is righteousness, will be clearly seen as light in the darkness, as bright as the noonday sun. And therefore, we need not fret when our righteousness goes overlooked, when the unrighteousness of the unrighteous appears like righteousness. The world mistakes our righteousness for something else, or Christians wrongly assess other Christians in their righteousness. For we know ultimately that righteousness will be vindicated. And this gives us confidence to choose the righteous path, even though it seems on occasion, or perhaps often, to be an unprofitable pursuit. Rather, trusting the Lord who oversees the world, we commit our way to him, trusting, just like perhaps the falsely accused Joseph, imprisoned by Pharaoh, that God will one day, even if not until the return of the king, until the great judgment, when all things are judged in perfect righteousness by the righteous king, God will one day expose righteousness for all to see. And such a life of trust, of commitment, of delight, subsequently generates a calm, quiet, peaceful patience in the righteous. And David says in verse 7, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself over the one who prospers in his way, over the man who carries out evil devices. Those who trust in the Lord don't merely abstain from fretfulness, but they also experience and exhibit a quiet, still restfulness while waiting for the Lord to accomplish his purposes in judgment. And fretfulness prevents, counteracts a quietness of soul, a stillness of heart before God, a restfulness of life, a patience in God's plans. You cannot be a fretful person and yet experience stillness, calmness, quietness with the Lord? Can I have a fretfulness and a patience for God's plans? And when the concept of suffering, that's the word for patience in Greek. Waiting patiently for the Lord involves the ability to endure existence with evil doing, awaiting for the Lord's resolution to wickedness. Now, waiting quietly before the Lord, I don't think means apathy towards wickedness. David often vocalized his eagerness to see the destruction of the wicked in what are called the imprecatory psalms, one of which is Psalm 140. David says, "Deliver me, O Lord, from evil men. Preserve me from violent men. Let burning coals fall upon them. Let them be cast into fire, into miry pits, no more to rise." Apparently, the righteous can yearn for the destruction of the wicked, humbly calling upon the Lord to render just judgment. That's a good prayer of David. He's just seeing what the Lord's work already is and asking for it to be done. But within that framework, we also carry out justice to the oppressed. Psalmist says, "God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment." In verses 3 and 4, here is God's judgment. "Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked." However, in the midst of all this, we must be careful in our mental posture and emotional attitude towards wickedness, towards evildoers. And for often, I think we find difficulty in separating anger from the actions. And David understood that anger, even this righteous indignation, as some call it, towards wickedness, possessed the capability to lead a person into sin. Where David says in verse 8, "Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself. It tends only to evil." And similarly, he says in Psalm 4, "Be angry and do not sin. Ponder in your own hearts on your beds and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and put your trust in the Lord." I think David, there's a proper expression of righteous indignation against evil. But David also says, assess the source of your anger in solitude. Don't speak while angry. Right? The internet is not the place to express your anger, your fretfulness. Ponder in your own hearts on your bed. He's talking about this, the source of the anger. What's causing this anger to stir up? And be silent. Don't speak while angry. In anger, offer right sacrifices. And don't neglect in anger to put your trust in the Lord. For often anger, or this fretfulness, belies a distrust in the Lord's works and plans. And the Apostle Paul quoted Psalm 4 in his letter to the Ephesians and believed himself that anger tended towards a behavior that ran counter to the calling of these Christians, the new self given to the Christians, the renewed mind, even the Spirit of God. And so he says in Ephesians 4, 26 and 27, "Be angry, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger." A day apparently seems enough for that anger. Okay, deal with it and be done with it. "And give no opportunity for the devil." Anger, fretfulness is an opportunity for the devil to start guiding actions rather than the Spirit of God. Now furthermore, the psalmist Asaph concluded that his own embitterment towards wickedness produced an improper response towards God himself. And he says in Psalm 73, you can go through Asaph and he's bemoaning the wickedness around him. And then he comes to verse 21 and 22. He says, "When my soul was embittered with thinking about all this evil doing, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast toward you." He's talking to God. And so before stirring yourself up in agitation and expressing anger over wickedness, even in this apparently biblical concept of righteous indignation towards evil, be sure to understand that anger quickly kindles into a blaze that consumes. Anger corrupts our righteous deeds. Anger stirs up anger and fretfulness. Our own fretfulness causes other people to not be encouraged in faith and hope and love, but rather to just join the chorus of fretfulness. Anger distorts our view of God and people. Anger and fretfulness run counter to love and evangelism. Right? And we ought to be careful of how we speak of others. And I'm constantly amazed at the eagerness of some people to diminish evil doing in others when it benefits their cause or benefits them politically, to excuse evil doing when it is their person, their guy, their girl, whatever. As well as to assume unrighteousness in others in a manner that clearly breaks the divine law of not bearing false witness. We demand due process in our legal courts, but it sometimes seems that we're willing to sling mud as quickly as we can scoop it up from the ground in order to produce a guilty verdict in the court of public opinion. And strangely, people seem to justify this behavior by claiming allegiance to the truth. Well, I'm just telling the truth. Not acknowledging that bearing false witness against another is extremely untruthful. And great harm to love and evangelism occur when we assume unrighteousness in others. Or even when we see unrighteousness, but we produce a wrong anger about it. Because I've never heard a person who claimed that Obama or whoever else you want to name, all these names are always going about, who's the Antichrist. I've never heard a person who claimed, who's disgusted at a person, embody love and mercy and evangelist intent towards those people. I've never heard a person back in these days, and I know there's all, it was Obama, and then it was the Pope, and now it's Bill Gates or somebody else. There's always some new Antichrist coming about. I've never seen a person who levels that charge who is truly loving and merciful and evangelistic towards that person. I mean, maybe they're out there, but I would think it would be impossible to love and to seek the good, the divine good, of those whom we view with disgust or false assumptions. And to be clear, we not speaking necessarily to anybody here, anybody I know, just, again, using the internet as a sounding board, which is can result in poor formation of what's actually going on. But a lot of talk about the Antichrist and this worry about the identity of the Antichrist and the mark of the beast, the great embodiment of evil. But John states in Revelation 13 and 14, you can read those chapters, that such will reveal themselves clearly. They will clearly be seen. They will raise up in that function, in that identity, for the purposes of express blasphemy against the Lord and exalt themselves as an object of worship and allegiance over and against God. Okay. Whatever evil you want to say evildoers do, there is a very clear purpose for those things. The mark of the beast is a very clear, read those chapters, it's a very clear allegiance and worship of this beast, this embodiment of evil, whatever it may be. John already, he's speaking to people back in the first century, to the churches, warning them about that situation. It's already happened. Seems like there's another one coming here at the end of days. But John also says that such will be risen up, will be revealed according to the authority of the Jesus. They will be given power to persecute by Jesus. John says that. The word ordains them. And then as quickly as they appear, the word judges them. We need not fret even about the worst embodiment of evil that will come against us. We need not try to make false assumptions about who this Antichrist or what this mark of the beast is. We've seen for what it is. It's not going to be somebody's going to accidentally capture you in the middle of the night and take you captive. And you're going to accidentally get the mark of the beast and wake up and suddenly you have inherited all the curses of the wicked while you were sleeping. Right? This is an intentional pursuit of allegiance and worship to the very embodiment of everything that is Antichrist. To worship an actual being. But God will judge and bring their work to an end as quickly as they rise up. And so in quiet trust, we submit ourselves to the Lord, the one who actively resolves wickedness. Verse 9 through 11, it says, "For evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land. In just a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace." We faithfully, eagerly, patiently, and restfully wait for the Lord, wait for such a day because of what the Lord accomplishes in regard to the righteous and to the wicked, which is an absolute dissevering of the wicked and an inheritance for the righteous meek. And meekness stands in, we've talked about this in the last couple of weeks, meekness stands in contrast to aggression. Jesus quotes this verse in the Sermon on the Mount. It says, "Blessed are the meek." Meekness stands in contrast to aggression. The meek are deferential, not possessing an attitude of self-importance. The meek rest confidently, unwilling to resort to hostilities. They trust the Lord to deliver and redeem, to grant their inheritance. And so the meek refuse to skirmish for their piece of the pie, to be agitated, for they know the size of God's piece of the pie, which is a piece for God to distribute sufficiently to all the meek. And here the meek in Psalm 37 stand in contrast to those who fret and envy. The meek understand the uselessness of fretfulness, of anger, of envy, because they understand the certainty of their future inheritance. An inheritance that David concludes brings delight in abundant peace. It's difficult to imagine a person delighting in abundant peace while fretting, harboring anger, possessing envy towards wickedness. And we know the coming future of abundant peace that we have with the Lord through Jesus Christ. We know that the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed one of God, died on the cross for sins in order to restore us to God Himself, to restore us to that communion with the great I Am. He was resurrected from the grave to bring vindication of His work and righteousness, and to join us to His new life. The very life that Christ has, He gives to us. This new life of glory. And we know this end is coming. Revelation 21 and 22. And that was already prophesied, especially by the prophet Isaiah. Go back and read, especially chapters 61 through 66 in Isaiah. This coming life instituted by the King, the culmination of His kingdom, where He renews the creation to perfect glory, the new heaven, new earth joined together as one, where John says that God dwells with man, where we experience every perfect thing and every creative genius in the mind and heart of God with him forever. That's what is gained for those who entrust themselves to Jesus. For those who acknowledge that Jesus is Lord, for those who confess to disagree with what God says, to repent, to turn from one's way to the ways of the kingdom. They know what is gained. We know what is gained by faith. And we let what is gained by faith, we let the eternal inheritance begin to guide and influence and impact our very actions now. Actions which bring about the cessation of fretfulness, the cessation of envy, a delight in the Lord himself, and a calm, still restfulness in the Lord, in his provision.